It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The national parks and refuges we enjoy today as Alaska outdoors people weren't always destined to be conserved for those purposes. After Alaska became a state, the map was opened as to which lands would be owned by Alaska Natives, the state government, or private owners. On today's show, we'll look back into that history, to the 1970s, to find out how it happened, as some lovers of Alaska's wild places sat down with maps and drew lines that became the largest single conservation action in world history, called ANILCA. How did it happen, and how did they choose? On today's show, my guests include those who made these decisions, including at the highest level, working with the president, down to the boots on the ground, exploring the watersheds of the Arctic to choose refuge boundaries. Well, my guest right now, I'm honored to have with me on the phone from Idaho, Governor Cecil Andrus was governor of Idaho 4 terms and was the Secretary of the Interior under President Jimmy Carter. And if there's anyone who was at the middle of the ANILCA lands battle, it was Cecil Andrus. He was at Jimmy Carter's side in deciding that they wanted to preserve a large part of Alaska, over 100 million acres. And he was there right at the end of the Carter administration when this actually took place. And for those of us who were not around in 1980, we are talking about a huge amount of land, almost a third of Alaska, which we now enjoy as national parks, refuges, wild and scenic rivers. And I'm just honored to have you on the show today, Governor Andrus. Thank you for being with us.
Well, Charles, it's my pleasure to spend a little bit of time visiting with you. The story of ANILCA and how it came about would take many, many hours to tell the in-depth story, but I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have. But I would just remind you that it was started in 1972 with the Native Claim Settlement Act, and the provisions that were in that law and why it was passed, Bubby. And then in 1976, Jimmy Carter was elected, and he and I discussed what issues we would handle in the interior, and one of the major ones was the resolution of the protection of Alaska lands. And I would just say that in Alaska, we had the opportunity to do it right the first time, and frankly, I think we did a pretty good job of it.
It's a pretty extraordinary thing that happened, and I believe the largest single conservation action in world history, at least up to that point, and perhaps has been surpassed since then. But just an extraordinary thing to occur. So, the Native Land Claims Bill said that there would be an area of land that would be studied for potential conservation units, and that was the D2 provision of the ANCSA Native Claims. But then 5 years later, still nothing had occurred. And when you came to office, and it sounds like you and President Carter sat down and decided, well, this is something we want to do. And tell us about that conversation.
Well, keep in mind that there was a provision in Section D2 that made it clear there was a 7-year period of time that none of the provisions of land selection would take place until the federal government had made their decision as provided within the act. We came in, as you point out, 4 years later, with only a little over 2 years left to make the selections. And right after Jimmy Carter was elected in November of 1976, I met with him in Plains, Georgia, and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was initiated at that point in time on the kitchen table in Plains, Georgia. It was one of the major issues that we decided that we would take on. And then there were lots of political activities that took place after that, and we had to I would be happy to go into detail with you in any areas that you want to.
I know there was a huge amount of opposition from within Alaska when folks used the word lockup and thought that this was going to be the end of the world. But you found some surprising allies, and one was Ted Stevens, who I think people would have thought of as be a sort of a build it and bulldoze it sort of guy, but he ended up being somebody who you could work with.
In the end, he was an ally, but keep in mind, there were hundreds, literally thousands of people throughout America, both in the lower 48 as well in Alaska, that helped bring this to fruition. It wasn't just me. It wasn't just President Carter. The list is long and surprising in some instances. But Ted Stevens started out as discussions with me as being one of the strongest opponents to the completion of the initial act in order that the boomers and the state and other entities in Alaska could make their drawings. In the end, Ted Stevens was a tremendous help in bringing this about, and he and I had many lengthy conversations in his office. And what brought it to fruition in the end was the move by President Carter to utilize the Antiquities Act, and myself as Secretary of the Interior using FLIPNA provisions for withdrawals, where we had run into a stone wall with some of the opponents in Alaska to make the selection process work, and they were just waiting for the time to run out so they could move in and glom on to some of the most important and most sensitive areas in that great state. We brought this into being with it. Appeared that we were not getting into the right end results. So we utilized the Carter administration under the president that we would withdraw these lands and protect them in perpetuity, and that might bring the Alaska delegation back to the table in negotiations. Well, it did, but it was a flaming discussion. First of all, Ted Stevens called me and jerked me up to the hill, and he said, "Mr. Secretary, you have misused the Antiquities Act." And I said, "Well, Senator, you may think we misused the Antiquities Act, but everything we did was legal, and we had an EIS completed on it, and that's the way it's going to be, but we would prefer that it be resolved legislatively." And then we started getting serious. He fumed a lot and cussed a lot and called me every name in the book, and gave interviews to the Times that what a scoundrel that the Carter administration was, and then we got to work. And Ted Stevens was one of the most knowledgeable people, but so was the staff that we had in the Interior Department. Some of those people, outstanding individuals, knew the state well, and Ted and I would sit in his office, and particularly in the area of the Brooks Range and some of the others, where he would say, "Now, here are where some of the hydrocarbons potential lies. Here's where the minerals are. Here's the sensitive areas." And then he'd say, "Well, I'm going back to Anchorage and probably say some unkind things about you." And I said, "That's fine." And he did just that, and then he'd come back, and he worked again to help us put together the final product. And
so the two of you were sitting down over a map and sort of picking out the areas where you could maybe carve back a little bit of what you're asking for, but maybe, you know, but pushing forward over there. And so it's sort of a negotiating process.
Well, that's true. We worked over the map. We didn't agree on everything, but in those days, you know, politics was the art of compromise. And the work that we did was for the betterment of what we thought was for the state of Alaska and all of the public in the 50 states. Ted's colleague in the Senate was of very little help. In fact, he was no help at all.
Mike Gravel.
And he caused, yes, he caused a lot of the confusion and the problems that took us so long to bring it to fruition. But Ted and I had one agreement, and that was that if they would work to bring about a bill that and it passed, one of the first paragraphs in that bill would be that it would amend or remove the Antiquities Act action taken by the president and the secretarial withdrawals by myself, and that's what brought him back to the table. And in 1980, the bill was 103 million acres onshore that were protected in the various categories, and as you pointed out early, it was not accepted by all the people of Alaska at that point in time, but since then has been proven that it was the right thing to do.
Indeed.
It is without doubt the greatest environmental conservation act that has ever been passed or ever will be passed, in my opinion.
Yes. It's Outdoor Explorer, and my guest today is none other than Governor Cecil Andrus, four-time governor of the state of Idaho and Secretary of the Interior under President Jimmy Carter, who is largely responsible for the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which I believe doubled the size of the national park system, massively increased the size of the national refuge system, and and protected something like almost a third of the state of Alaska in conservation units, which our listeners now use all the time. And you may not know who to thank. Well, the person on the line with me today would be high on the list.
Let me interrupt you and correct that. You've said that I was largely responsible. Yes, I worked on it. I was in the right chair at the right time. But as I said, hundreds and hundreds of people worked on this. And we had a president who was agreeable to the protection activity. And Ted Stevens' help and all of the staff, they're the ones that did it.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because I was curious as to how, when you are doing this negotiation with Ted Stevens and doing the other work on ANILCA, how you knew which areas were the most precious, the most important to take care of, because Alaska is so large and it really had only not even really been completely mapped. I mean, there wasn't really a complete knowledge of everything that was out there in those days in the 1970s. So you must have had some people who were scouting it pretty well.
Well, keep in mind, there's a long history in Alaska, and there weren't that many secrets. We had professionals in the Park Service, the U.S. Geological Survey, the BLM, the Forest Service, the people. They knew those parts of Alaska, and where the areas were that should be protected. And I had an outstanding group of people within the Department of Interior that had backgrounds in Alaska. So we had plenty of knowledge. What we had to do was to have the will that it would take to compromise and to put together the most important part. And if you go up in the area of Kaktovik, where the largest reserve is protected, 19 million acres. That was one of the most difficult areas because of the knowledge of the hydrocarbon potential that on the plains there that were involved in the area that we protected. So there was plenty of knowledge. It was just what we could put together. Now, keep in mind, we protected 103 million acres, but that left 254 million acres that was open for selection.
Right, right. Well, and I'm curious because Ted Stevens obviously tragically died in a plane crash after the legal issues and everything else. We don't need to get into that in detail, but I know that he often spoke of broken promises of the Lands Act and of ANCSA, the No More Clause, which was the idea there would be no more conservation lands, and also his desire to open up oil drilling in Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I wonder if you ever felt that there were any broken promises or if those issues that he raised and that other pro-development Alaskans had raised, if there's any validity to those. And there's also been discussion of access and, you know, various other topics along those lines.
There were no broken promises on the part of the Carter administration, and I can't speak for some of the former gubernatorial personage in Alaska. And you know, the people were doing what they thought was right, and I don't condemn them for that. But the only broken promises that I ran into were from Bob Gravel.
Mike Gravel.
Gravel. At that point in time, he was the United States Senator, a colleague of Ted Stevens. He lied to us as to he'd signed off on his acceptance, and then he went south the next day. He was no help. He wouldn't come to the meetings. He didn't participate in the discussions, yet he had the power as United States Senator to put a hold on any proposed legislation. And that's basically what he started out to do and forced us to utilize the Antiquities Act to bring him back to the table.
Yeah. So as President Carter's term was ending, and obviously other issues were much at the front of his desk in terms of the hostage crisis in Iran and a presidential election, then President Reagan wins the election, and he designates James Watt as Interior Secretary, who is, of all the people in the country, was the most likely to oppose this sort of legislation. You had to bring it in for a landing very, very quickly at the very end, because I certainly have the impression in looking back that President Reagan and James Watt never would have supported this kind of conservation law. Is that true?
No, that's very true. You've analyzed that correctly. But I would point out to you that we had a strength in the Congress, both with John Seiberling and Mo Udall leading up in the House side, with Frank Church and Scoop Jackson and others in the Senate side, that we knew we had to get this legislation passed and be in the lame duck session, because you're right. James Watt and Ronald Reagan had said they would not support it, and we were fortunate that everything came together. It was passed and signed into law by President Carter, and one of the major accomplishments of the Carter administration, certainly in the area of natural resources.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating to look back on this and think of how close we really came to not having these lands that are so precious to us now, that so many of us use all the time, in being protected, and the struggle that was necessary. And I think it's important to remind generations that kind of struggle is part of the world that we get to enjoy in the future. And as you think back on it, you must get a great deal of satisfaction from thinking about this. I know you're quite an outdoorsman yourself, and Have you been to Alaska in the year since and had an opportunity to sort of think about what was accomplished?
Yes, I have, and I've enjoyed some of the conversations. And I still get an occasional pieces of mail of people saying, Mr. Secretary, I hated your guts when you were doing all this, but I'm thrilled that it was accomplished with what I see now. And so there's been a tremendous shift in the attitude. But keep in mind, we protected 103 million acres, but there were 254 million acres that were still open for the native claim settlements, where the native corporations made their selections, where the state made their selections and the others. And there is still a hydrocarbon potential that from, if you go from Prudhoe and go east through past Point Thompson towards Kaktovik, there continues to be hydrocarbons available there that could be developed. But you've got a transportation problem, you've got a price of oil problems, and you've got economics. But it was a pure myth for people saying it would lock up all of the resources. There are still minerals being extracted not on the lands we protected, but on the other lands of the state, and there's hydrocarbon potential there that can be brought south when it's economically feasible to do so.
Yeah, and it's interesting how the attitudes have changed. That a mineral prospect like the Pebble prospect, which was so enormous, was on state land, on land that was actually designated for mining. But there seems to have been a public consensus, at least by a majority of Alaskans, that they didn't want to develop that because of the fishing of Bristol Bay. And so these battles go on, and I suppose they always will. But the Anilka law was perhaps the biggest marker and the biggest conservation move that will, as you say, has been done or will be done. And I guess for that, we thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Well, listen, it was a tremendous pleasure for me to be involved in this situation with some of the finest people inside of government and outside of government, people from all walks of life that contributed to the passage of this outstanding piece of legislation.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Governor Cecil Andrews of Idaho, as you've heard, and thanks for being with us so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, my next guest for today's Outdoor Explorer, as we explore how we got all these amazing public lands in Alaska that we use all the time, is Fran Maurer. And Fran was one of those staff members that Governor Andrews was praising as being kind of the key to making the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act come into being, the folks who were on the ground and figuring out which lands needed to be conserved, and going through all of the process of studying maps and studying natural resources to decide about the expansion of the national parks and national wildlife refuges. And I have one of those on the ground people with me right now. Fran Maurer was a wildlife biologist trained at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then kind of jumped into the middle of things. Worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service on what was then called the D2 issue, which was the study of these lands coming out of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, and worked through that until it was concluded, and then spent the rest of his career working in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge until retiring in 2002. And Fran is joining us today from Fairbanks. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So for those who don't know the history, and I'm guessing most Alaskans probably don't, this huge public land conservation law came out of the Native Claims Settlement. There was a provision in the Native Claims called Provision D2, which required setting aside and studying these lands for conservation, and that set up a decade of essentially of a decade-long political fight as to which lands would be selected. And you were mentioning that you were still a student when ANCSA passed, when the Native Claims Settlement passed.
Yes, I was, and it's ironic that you happened to call today because I got to realizing that the tomorrow, the 13th of December, is the 45th anniversary of passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which set in motion the provision under 17D2 for Congress to consider designating parks and wildlife refuges and wilderness in Alaska.
And you were mentioning that you were in the car and heard this announced on the radio and didn't know probably that it was going to really consume the rest of your career.
Yes, that's right. Congressman Nick Begich was our congressman for Alaska at that time, and he was on the air explaining how passage of this law, which I didn't know hardly anything about at that time. I had just come up to Alaska that summer, and I didn't know much about it at the moment. But he was explaining how it would be such a far-reaching, had very far-reaching consequences, and little did I know that I'd get involved in it as much as I did at that time anyway.
So in 1976, you were assigned to work on the D2 issue, or this lands issue. What job were you given? What were you doing?
Well, it was a job, a kind of a refuge planning type job in a planning division of the Anchorage Fish and Wildlife Service office at the time, and its mission was to provide resource information that would feed into the legislative proposals that were before Congress, to provide information to Congress on this issue. And so I wanted to say, first of all, that the identification of important wildlife areas, and I'll speak mostly from a standpoint that I know best, is the proposed wildlife refuges. I certainly work with Park Service planners as well quite closely, but I'm not as familiar with all the details of the park proposals as I am more so of the wildlife refuges. At any rate, what I wanted to say was that the most important and most rich and productive wildlife habitats in the state have been well known for a very long time. I mean, it really goes back to early Native peoples settling in these wildlife-rich areas because of the abundance of wildlife that they relied on for their sustenance. And many of these areas happen to coincide with the lowland interior river basins, which were full of lakes and ponds, which are also important for nesting waterfowl, which at the time the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was very involved with protecting and preserving waterfowl habitat for migratory birds, etc. So it's been known for a long time, but also there was a whole cadre of pioneer biologists that came well before me, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had been fulfilling basically the management function that is now largely continued on by the Alaska Fish and Game since statehood. But prior to statehood, during territorial days, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had lots of boots on the ground, or considerably anyway for those times. And these pioneers had great knowledge of these rich wildlife areas that are now protected in refuges. So I wanted to make that acknowledgement up front early in the game because a lot of at least the basic work had already been done with at least zeroing in on the most important areas.
Right, and it's in a lot of the times, and we've seen this across the country in conservation issues regarding refuges and parks, is that the lands that are most valuable for wildlife habitat are also the lands that are most valuable for human use, for kind of obvious reasons. In Alaska, essentially the federal government had stated ownership of the entire state. Native Americans obviously felt differently. When Alaska became a state in 1959, the 360 million acres of Alaska, it promised 103 million acres to the state of Alaska to select from out of that area within 25 years. And then when ANCSA passed, the Alaska Natives were given 44 million acres roughly to select. And then the D2 provision said, but we're also going to withdraw some land for conservation. So there's quite a competition here between the state, the natives, the feds, and then the best lands, obviously, are the ones everyone wants.
To some degree, I think the state, of course, had a greater interest in economic development because a big part of the statehood battle and question was whether or not Alaska could support itself as a state.
So they were looking for oil and gas and minerals and that sort of thing.
Right. And so the objectives for state land selections were not entirely the same as the, say, the federal conservation areas, but certainly there's areas where there was controversy. That's for sure.
What were some of the, tell us some of the biggest controversies that you were aware of?
Well, one of the biggest ones we're still wrangling over, that's the coastal plain of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, which the original Arctic Wildlife Range had been established prior to statehood. And, of course, now the state of Alaska would like to get into the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge and drill for oil. Another one that was a big controversy at the time ANILCA passed was a huge molybdenum deposit in the Misty Fjords area. It was highly controversial at the time.
Near Ketchikan, right.
Down near Ketchikan, right. As a couple of examples, and, you know, there's others, of course, too, but those are a couple of examples, anyway, of where there's some strong conflict of purposes.
So what was the role of a wildlife biologist in resolving those types of conflicts? I mean, were you out sort of verifying that wildlife was there, or were you drawing lines on a map? How did you actually interface with this process?
Well, back to the lines on the map business, as I said earlier, there was general knowledge of the basic areas of greatest wildlife importance. And right after the Native Claims Settlement Act in December, the Fish and Wildlife Service gathered its pioneer biologists and managers together for what the agency, just in internal agency lingo, called the December exercise. And they gathered these pioneer people with a lot of experience together with a huge pile of maps back in Washington, D.C. People like Jim King, who's still with us, living down in Juneau, Bob C. Otter Jones, Calvin Lensink, Averill Thayer, Ray Tremblay, Dave Spencer, and many others were involved in marking up maps of these actual areas. And I believe they had delineated close to 100 million acres of potential wildlife refuge lands. And then from that, various versions of proposals were advanced during the D2 era, starting with the Roger C.B. Morton, Secretary of Interior during President Ford's time, recommended, that was the first administrative proposal for parks and refuges. And I was going to add that during the period of 1972 to 74, the Interior Department organized what they called the Alaska Task Force, which was a gathering of various agency experts and people, and primarily oriented at preparing environmental impact statements for all of these proposed areas. And there's something in the order of 30 environmental impact statements that were developed for the refuges, parks, and wild scenic rivers was an enormous exercise. I didn't get involved until 2 years after those impact statements were over. And primarily at about the time that President Carter and Cecil Andrus took the reins of the administration back in D.C.
Probably much more enthusiastic about the idea than President Ford had been.
The size of the areas were expanded greatly. During that same time period, there was a citizen conservationist effort done by a number of Alaskan conservationists. Many of them were associated with an organization that existed at that time. It was called the Alaska Conservation Society. Folks like Celia Hunter, Ginny Wood, Bob Whedon, and many others, they also gathered in homes and cabins and pored over maps spread out on the floor to identify areas. And some of this Fish and Wildlife Service information was certainly utilized in their map-making business as well. So this all came together. Nothing happened in Congress, really, in the Ford administration. Congress really did not get rolling on it until the Carter administration. And the big event was when Congressman Morris Udall, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, introduced a bill called H.R. 39, and that really swung things into high gear. And so at the time that I got involved with this, we had a lot of groundwork already laid by these pioneer biologists, and we ended up having to modify boundaries. The work that had been done previously, boundaries were drawn on straight lines, township lines, section lines, and we were encouraged to expand the boundaries to include watersheds rather than just the lowland wetland areas because of lessons learned from the lower 48, where unfortunately conservation came along kind of late in the game, and surrounding uplands were often more heavily developed, and the swamps were still still intact for the birds. But what we learned was that what happens upstream or in the uplands, from a standpoint of pollution, such as agricultural pollution from fertilizers and things like that, ends up in the wetlands. And by the time we were working on these things, it was well known that there's big problems if the watersheds are not.
It's all one system, yeah.
Protected, and so we were motivated to consider trying to draw boundaries that would include watersheds and as much of an ecological, so-called ecosystem approach to things.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today with some folks who were involved in the biggest conservation measure ever to pass, at least in our country, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. And right now, my guest from Fairbanks is Fran Maurer, who's a wildlife biologist who is involved, as we're hearing, in crafting this legislation. So, Fran, in determining these watersheds and these boundaries, did that mean putting boots on the ground, so to speak, to go out and investigate?
To a limited degree. A lot of it was done with this prior knowledge and looking at the topography involved. I could give you an example. The boundary that Morris Udall's H.R. 39 had between the Arctic Wildlife Refuge proposed extension and the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge was just a straight line between the two areas over to the Canada border. And Cecil Andrus and the Carter administration wanted to demonstrate that they could add something from a scientific or professional perspective and improve the boundaries. So as an example, you know, I was instructed to take a look at that straight line and come up with a rationale for a watershed and ecosystem type of delineation between those two refuges. So the southernmost boundary of the Arctic Refuge and the northeastern boundary of the Yukon Flats was a line that I helped develop that largely delineated the wetland basin of the Yukon Flats, which is primarily oriented towards waterfowl, moose, and fur bears, and the uplands, which included caribou migration corridors leading from Alaska into Canada. So that's the kind of tweaking of these boundaries that I sometimes got involved with.
Tweaking, but involving like a massive amount of land and also some really important biological connections that that really make a big difference, but probably in Washington, people might not understand, but I think folks who actually go out there and understand these areas would see the importance of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
Was there a little bit of a translation issue there between the biologists and the politicians?
There's all kinds of stories I could share on that realm. I feel very fortunate, you know, beginning my career in as a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I feel very fortunate to have had this opportunity to be involved in such a historic conservation event at the beginning of my career. You would think that it would occur at the end of your career rather than at the beginning, but I had this unique opportunity. And we had organized our planning organization into regions of the state, and my region of the state was Northwest and Arctic Alaska. So we were detailed into Washington, D.C. from time to time to help with the effort there in providing analyses of resource, attempting to quantify some of the wildlife resources involved in various boundary configurations. It got to be quite an exercise in trying to ferret out these numbers for the senators and congressmen who were advocating one boundary over another and arguing over them.
I imagine. And I would think you would also be dealing with just this very strong opposition from a lot of Alaskans who saw this as a lockup or a loss of resources that could be developed, you know, or from oil or minerals, and I get the impression a lot of that opposition was just kind of a hell no variety, and therefore maybe didn't get too involved in the details, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, it was some of both. There was some people that had some details in mind in opposition. Much of it was more, idealistic. And certainly there was a lot of misinformation floating around during that time and exaggeration, and there was a lot of fear in ordinary citizens' mind about what this might mean, and would there be a future for Alaska and its economy, or would this truly be some kind of huge federal overreach and lockup where Alaska really couldn't persist as a bona fide state, and so there was a lot of fear and misinformation in all quarters, and it probably was aimed from both sides of the conflict as well.
Yeah, so I've heard about Park Service employees and other federal employees who had some really severe negativity directed towards them, burnings and effigy and that sort of thing. Were you aware of that kind of thing, and did you face any of that kind of thing?
I didn't face very much of it on a personal basis, for sure. But certainly, you know, the Tanana Valley Fair in 1979, I believe it was, before the act passed, this was at the time that embassy, U.S. State Department embassy people in Iran were held hostage, And at the Tanana Valley Fair, they had an opportunity where people could pay a dollar to, I forget what, I guess to throw rocks at pictures of Jimmy Carter, Morris Udall, and the Ayatollah.
Wow.
And they burned Jimmy Carter in effigy in front of the Fairbanks federal building. But there were more serious matters out in the field after the Lands Act had first passed, especially down in the Glen Allen area, where I believe a Park Service airplane was burnt up as one act of violence, I guess you could call it, or destruction. But I didn't have any personal threats or anything like that.
Did you have a sense that you had to be careful out there?
Yeah. There's certainly try to be polite and try to be helpful when people ask questions or made statements. Yes, that was. We had to, be careful and cognizant of other people's fears and take them into account.
Yeah. So when you your next step in your career was working in Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is easily the most controversial of our wildlife refuges because of the belief of some that there's a large amount of oil there that they'd like to explore for. So in a sense, I guess you never really got away from being in the middle of these big political issues.
No, it's like out of the frying pan into the fire because the Lands Act that we ended up finalizing was the Senate version of the bill. The House version would have made the coastal plain would have designated it as wilderness, and my job at Arctic Refuge would have been much easier. But instead, the Senate version had Section 17 1002, which required a resource assessment of the wildlife and the habitat and the potential oil resources there, and to identify potential impacts. And I was, brought into the middle of that. So I had an opportunity to not only be involved in helping the movement to establish new conservation areas, but then got involved in the implementation of at least that provision of the law.
So briefly, as we wrap up here, Fran, I wanted to ask about your looking back on this historic event and the way perceptions of it have changed over the decades since. Obviously, there's still a lot of conversation about oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but for the most part, these lands seem to really become a sort of a treasured part of Alaska's recreation and also of our economy in terms of the millions of tourists who come to Alaska every year. How do you feel when you look back at this span of time and how things have come about since then?
Well, I think you're completely correct about, overall, most of the areas that have been set aside on federal lands as a result of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act have the fears and the worry of Alaskan lifestyle being heavily restricted has really not come to pass, in my opinion. There may be some people in the listening audience who feel differently, but the tourist economy has increased over time to a point where I know one example you may be familiar with too is down on the Kenai Fjords, the community of Seward. At the time the Lands Act passed, the community had passed a resolution or taken some position in total opposition to establishment of the Kenai Fjords National Park. And now, years later, because of the cruise ship and boat excursion opportunities for visitors and the economics of it, Seward has taken the opposite position and mm-hmm. strongly supportive of that park in that area. And I think that's often the case in many other of the conservation areas that were established.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Fran Maurer, wildlife biologist, now retired, was with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for many years. Thanks for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about ANILCA, this huge land bill, which has been called the largest conservation measure ever passed, and put over 100 million acres of Alaska in various conservation units, parks, refuges, wild and scenic rivers. And as outdoors folks, we love having these lands protected. But there's a flip side to ANILCA. Not everybody thought it was the greatest idea, and not everybody thinks it has been administered the way it should have been. My next guest is going to give us some of that perspective. Former Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell is also the author of a curriculum on ANILCA, which is used by federal land managers, and is also an avid outdoors person, also loves all these lands, also is glad that these lands are protected. But there's a footnote to that protection, and there's some real issues that still exist. And thanks for being with us, Mead.
Good to be with you, Charles.
So ANILCA, I mean, was very controversial, and there were a lot of concerns about what would happen if it passed. How do you feel about the original bill? I mean, was it about as good as you would get? Is it? Are there things that were wrong about it?
Well, there was a faction of Alaskans who, of course, we had a senator named Mike Gravel who killed the bill in 1978. And when the bill came up again in 1980, you got to remember it was passed after Jimmy Carter lost the election. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Carter was up here for one of the ANILCA anniversaries and said that, well, the Reagan people had told him, go ahead and get that bill passed. Well, I went back and checked with Martin Anderson, who was Reagan's domestic policy advisor and others, and said, we don't remember telling him that.
Right.
I do remember making a trip with Governor Wally Hickel in September of 1980, where we saw Reagan's campaign chairman, the guy later, Bill Casey, who later headed the CIA. And we said, you know, we'd like to not see this bill pass until Reagan gets into office because we think the protections for Alaskans can be better. We're not against a bill that actually sets aside and has some of these national parks, but the bill is so problematic in many, many different ways for industry, for inholders, for Alaska Fish and Game Management, for people who wanted to, you know, make sure that we understood which lands were being set aside and what were the mineral values. And so the hope had been by a large set of Alaskans, Commonwealth North was one organization that supported continuing the debate past the 1980 time that it was passed.
So moving forward in time, the bill is passed. These lands are set aside. But Senator Ted Stevens was in there negotiating with Cecil Andrus and came up with some provisions that made these public lands very different from most in the lower 48, which were perceived as protections for Alaskans and for access and minerals and some of these things you're talking about. Do you feel like those provisions have been respected?
In some cases, yes, in some cases not. Each national park, and we found this when we did a set of case studies for this ANILCA curriculum. And by the way, this curriculum is not only open for a class for federal land managers, many of whom come up here and have to learn the difference between a national park in Alaska and a national park, say, in Montana, because the enabling legislation is very different. But also it's available for Alaskans who want to understand what their rights are under ANILCA and want to try to protect them. And the Institute of the North has got another class they're signing up for this spring, and I urge people to take it. It's a very interesting history on these lands issues, but you know, if you look at it now, 36 years later, there are people who believe that inholders' rights were not very well protected. There's people who believe that the National Park Service, for example, did not respect traditional users when they were told to respect traditional uses in Denali, the expanded Denali Park, for example. I'm a traditional user. I'm somebody who liked to ski in that park. Snow machining was something that people do on the south side of the park, and some of the restrictions that went on, I think, were not comporting with the law. There was one part of the compromise in the law that required mineral assessments. The Clinton administration ended those in the early 90s, that document and that whole process doesn't go on any further. And in fact, that mineral assessment process has led to the development of some major mines in Alaska. The process of requiring essentially an act of Congress to get access across some of these lands when we knew access would be an issue, it's an access to get to the mineral belt in the Brooks Range, for example, across gates of the Arctic National Park. We had to do a land exchange to make Red Dog happen. Those were some problematic issues at the time. Senator Stevens put it this way. He said there, and John Katz, who ran the state's office in Washington for many years, is that the law permitted certain things, and now the way the bureaucrats have done it is we now require permits for those things.
And do you feel like that's just the passage of time, and bureaucrats are in their offices and do their thing, whereas the public is difficult to push back? So once the compromise is made, it sort of always moves back in the direction of the government.
The government does have absolute power on these things. But, you know, let me put it this way. It's very important to look at ANILCA in the context of the Statehood Act, the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, Mineral Leasing Act that kept the subsurface estate for the federal government and so forth. When we became a state, we thought we had very clear signals that we would manage fish and game. Well, the way the Interior Department especially has come back and said, we're going to put up no trespassing signs and tell state game managers that they can't go manage, say, predators in a federal land use area, that to me is an abrogation of the Statehood Act. You know, that's a real problem. And frankly, what it did is it set up two and maybe three with some native management different land managers for the same game population, or managers for the same game population, and that's no way to manage a population for abundance. So we've got to sort that one out. The issue on the Yukon River that we saw with both the sturgeon case and the wild case, where the National Park Service is saying, we're going to put these rules on this navigable water. Well, the state has control of setting the rules on navigable water, and now, you know, some magistrate in Fairbanks says it's nested rules. And that ends up to muddy the situation. It makes it very, very difficult to do it. The state doesn't want to do irresponsible things. We've, restricted jet skis in Kachemak Bay, for example. We've done a number of different things to make sure that people who want quiet wilderness enjoy quiet wilderness. But we've got this power game between the federal government and the state on those issues that have caught up real live individuals in the problems. And John Sturgeon went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court unanimously said, well, we're not sure that this is the right interpretation of ANILCA, and the Park Service was unrepentant. And, so we're going to have to see how that one settles out. The wild case was awful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an ongoing thing, which will probably never end, right? Because these are big issues and big issues between state power and federal power. And I wish we had more time, but I really want to thank you, Mead Treadwell, for being with us today, a former lieutenant governor and expert and curriculum writer on ANILCA. Thanks for being with us.
It's great. And I think there are ways to resolve this, and let's keep working at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's all for today's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolfarth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.